I'll try to recap very briefly what we've said. We've been talking about the potential of renewal through a small group. Does he even have a copy of the white? No, I don't. Is someone who hasn't been here at all yet? You've been here before?
Yeah.
I should know that. The principle behind the small group is that rather than to do as happens in many situations, in many churches, to say we're going to have small groups, and one small group is going to specialize in Bible study, another in fellowship, another in this, and another in that. This is attempting to challenge the small group to be involved in the five functions of the Christian life, which we describe as worship, fellowship, witness, service, and nurture. Now, we have prepared a model, and that model calls for challenging members of the congregation to gather together into groups of 10 to 15 adults, preferably families. This isn't always possible, but preferably families. And as these groups come together, and we have prepared a system of study, we have a series of 26 lessons. Lessons almost always will take two meetings. This would be the kind of material which would go into the hands of every member of the group, at least every family. And then after a time, the groups will then identify and select their own leaders. These leaders are rising out of the community itself in each case, and those leaders will have this material, which in effect is the same material as that, but expanded, or I should say starts on the basis of this material and expands it, but does it in non-technical language. There are two other books with a white backbone on them, but those books were, they weigh about 4 or 5 pounds, and I didn't bring those along with me. I didn't realize how simple it was to get all this stuff up here to Holden. Now, the white back book is the material which will be available for the pastor of the congregation, and again, deals with the same subject matter, but does it in rather technical language and brings it out of theological books. Where possible, we have gotten off-prints from technical books, and where it hasn't been possible to take off-prints, or where a book is out of print, we have, a number of us have taken up taking a book and having an extended book review of it, an analysis and a book review of something, so as to give the pastor some material so that he can reach to one place and get the material instead of having to go out and buy $150 worth of books because we recommend it. Okay, now I would like this evening to get the discussion going as soon as possible. May I ask you first of all to hold these two models in front of you. I have not put many lines in the model, but let me run through them rather rapidly. Let's start with the traditional model. In the traditional model, you have the congregation at the, that's the basic unit. You notice I have put what look like check marks, but are supposed to be these around that. And by that I mean that the congregation is constituted by the people who come to church on Sunday mornings and are members of the congregation, but the visitors are people who come to the congregation, and depending upon the cordiality of the elders and deacons, they either figure that they are welcome or they figure they aren't so very welcome. At any rate, here is a continuing problem that you have. What do you do about visitors in a congregation? This seems to be a cause of bitterness among a lot of people who have been exposed to a church and they don't know what they're doing with it. So that's one problem, which again I believe the Koinonia system deals with. Then the congregation is operated. The pastor has his basic responsibility. For those who came late, there are two of these yellow sheets. I think they're on the chair back there. One of them, as in the upper left-hand corner, come model, and the other, traditional model. I'm speaking of the traditional model now. And here I'm suggesting some of the standing boards which a congregation will have. Finance, evangelism, worship, Christian ed, benevolences. There may be different ways in which it's divided. That isn't the main point. But someone last night said the real problem is that it's nice to load those responsibilities on one or two members of the congregation who are willing to do it. Then in addition to that, let me say that these standing boards are all small groups, but they're groups with one direct responsibility. Then they're auxiliary groups, youth group, church women, young couples group, men's society, old folks society, whatever you want to say there might be in a congregation. Again, I've given examples. And then there are also, and these are not exclusive, this large number of M's here, which stands for members of the congregation. Then the church has its responsibility toward reaching out to the world of need and opportunity. And I suppose it would be an interesting exercise to take, to use your imagination and to draw lines. How do those lines really work? The line between the church, the congregation and the standing boards. The line between the congregation and the auxiliaries. Between all the members. Do members really feel a membership to the congregation? And above all, what are the directions in which the congregation reaches out to the world of need and opportunity? And in that, how does it reach out to all those little O's around there, people who are other, who are outside of the congregation? Whether they happen to be people who are just standing on the roadside and watching the Christians go in and out, whether they are people who have been turned off by the church, what are the means by which you are going to get to them, and what are the means by which you are going to approach the world of need and opportunity? Last night, someone, I think it was Jan, said that one of the problems is that a congregation can put together a lot of money, and then it says, well, we'll give it to this or that purpose. But how? As Ralph said, Ralph raised the further question, can a congregation really get into the real messy business of, shall we say, the political scene, where maybe something really has to be done? These are the problems that face a congregation in this one model. Now, this other model is one which I am suggesting that you don't say, let's get rid of this model and use this one. But I think it's one that can be superimposed upon it. I'm going to be optimistic. When this model takes hold, namely the come model, of having small groups who begin to ask the really important questions of reaching out in witness, service, showing the rest of the world that they worship, that reaching back for nurture and having this kind of fellowship, I suggest that the importance of many of these other groups is going to be different. For example, the finance committee is really going to be just that. It's going to be responsible for taking care of the finances, but the people within the koinonias are going to be inquiring of the finance committee. What are you doing? Why are we spending money on this or that? How can we make our baptism really meaningful? So that's the way in which I see that these two things come together. And I would see as an ideal that ultimately it's very possible that some of the people will say, you know, we really have things going in such a way that we don't need some of these auxiliaries. not because the auxiliaries aren't any good, but because the function of the auxiliaries is taken care of by the small groups. One of the reasons I submit that you have men's clubs and women's societies, one of the reasons, is that somehow or other we haven't had vehicles for having families coming together. And yet it is in the family that the Christian growth is most important. That's the place where Christian growth really has its best seedbed, the place where it can flourish best. Now I want to mention very briefly a number of other things, and then I'd like to open it up for discussion, because we don't have that much time tonight. We have to break a little early. Another thing, would you look at the come model and try to superimpose another idea here? I would like to suggest that in place of congregation, you write three, four, or five, don't write, but think, three, four, or five-point parish. That is, in some of the sparsely settled areas. I visited in Saskatchewan. You're here, aren't you, from Saskatchewan? Yes. I visited in Saskatchewan some time ago, and I saw one pastor who literally had to skate, and I think that was probably the proper term, skate across that countryside something like 160 miles every Sunday in order to fulfill his responsibility of taking care of small groups. And the small groups were something like 20 people in each place. Now, I would suggest you have a five-point parish in which the pastor is there. He is pastor of all five of these. And these, instead of being koinonias, or would be in Humboldt, there is one koinonia. In Bruno, there's another koinonia. In Middle Lake, which is larger, let's say, is large enough to have two or three koinonias. So that in all of these places, there will be worshiping communities who are gathered together and have chosen their own leadership from among themselves. And the function of the pastor of the congregation is not, first of all, to race from one place to the other, say amen and ask someone to have his car running so that he can get to the next place in time for that service. But rather, his function will be to be equipping these pastoral leaders in each group, that he will find opportunity to meet with them, preferably in some central place where they can get together, and to nurture them. And then on Sundays, he can go to town one and have a real pastoral relationship with people only once in 5 weeks. But that doesn't mean that the gospel and sacraments are, that the gospel is not being preached and the sacraments are not being administered in those places. The potential for that sort of thing, I think, is very great. It means that we've got to rethink a good deal about what we now think about in regard to what a pastor does. Another suggestion that I, and now let me suggest various possibilities. One of them is in a university setting. Harold and I were talking before the meeting began. He said there seemed to be some possibilities there. I admit one difficulty with a university setting, and that is that students are in 1 year, and, well, 9 months is about the length of time that you can figure on having the students. It has worked in some of these places where students really get turned on, and what they lack in continuity, they often can make up for in tremendous energy and the desire really to meet frequently and to grow in their understanding of their calling in the gospel. And really to challenge young people to look among themselves and finally say, Joe over there is the fellow who we see as having the gift. If we take John 3 seriously, that the Spirit blows where he wishes, And if we take 1 Corinthians 12 seriously, that everyone has a gift, we're going to see that there are different gifts and that there is this gift in every group. We have used it even as an educational model. At Seminex, we used this for a time as a way in which we put a number of subjects together and were able to teach them in the context of working through the problems and then going out and doing something about them and bringing it all within the context of prayer and worship and fellowship. I could see possibilities for Holden working in that way, but there are very definite problems. If I understand correctly, John, from you have a sort of a permanent community here of about 20 people. Okay, all right, continuation of 20. Then you have staff which is here from up to three weeks to 6 months, something like that. Then you have, I was almost going to say ships that pass in the night, but you don't have
5,000 people for varying other periods of time.
Yes. So, you have, however, it seems to me, I always like this, the bigger they are, the harder they fall. There's a real opportunity here. If it is possible that the nucleus of 20 could form, let us say, three koinonias as sort of a continuing community, if that nucleus then has as its, along with it, an involvement of the staff, and it would seem to me that this whole thing can be built up during the winter time when that relationship can be built up, then when your 5,000 troops come in and out, the 5,000 troops can be told, we're having one of these koinonias one evening. If you want to see how it works, you don't have to listen to Herb Zorn sound off about it, but you can see how the thing is actually working. I don't want to lay this on you, but I usually do. But this seems to me to be a potential thing that can happen. I could see it working in some of these retirement homes. I'm not speaking particularly of a place. You use retirement homes where people in their can live in a certain place and then they really have care for the rest of their lives. But people who are still reasonably active, I can see it working in some of the places in the southern part of the United States where there's a good deal of this going on. I find myself getting very excited about the potential of it. And while I do that, I want to add one thing in before I open this up, and that is that it is certainly possible that individual koinonias are simply not going to work. It has happened that sometimes when the thing is announced, there are a number of people who really are so full of hurts and pains that they say, we want to have a koinonia, we want to be able to share our difficulties. But the difficulty is that everybody is there, and it's sort of a group therapy session. And after a while, everybody's saying, I want to complain next. And then it's going to be necessary. And that's where the leadership of the pastor of the congregation comes in. It may be necessary to celebrate the death of that particular koinonia group and to regroup in something that has more potential for growth. As Paul says in 1 Corinthians 12, we are not all hands, we are not all noses, and we are not all tongues, and so maybe we can't all be complainers in a koinonia. And yet, if there's no one in a koinonia who complains, you probably are the poorer for it also. Okay, now I've tried to put out some vision. I'm sure there ought to be some doubts and some questions. What do you do if?
I'd like to just pick up right where you were leaving off. Maybe you covered this the other night and I missed it, but how were the groups originally put together? Because of geographic, a single parish in a typical community, people that live near each other, or common interests, or you want families.
As much as possible, families. I think it was Frank Lee, your friend in Washington, D.C., who had a very interesting way of doing it. He, check me out if I'm wrong on this, but at least it was a man in Washington who invited the congregation to discuss the program, and when they came in, they saw that Northwest Washington, whatever it was, you know, Northwest, South of the church, etc. Will you all please sit in the parts here that pertain to you? And when he had them all sitting, he spoke about the program very briefly, and he said, "No, I think I don't want to force this on you. It may be that you really want to be in a group in another section, or you think that it won't work if you're in that particular group. No, if you wish, change." And then these people, a few people, got up and changed it. But basically, it was a geographical approach. It might not be possible in certain places. But I think it's very important to use something that doesn't simply permit people who really are very good friends already to become kind of cliquish. The other great question that arises is, how do you get it started? Well, what I did at Holy Sacrament Church was to meet with all the families or groups of families. We had them over in the evenings. I went over to their houses. If Mohammed, the mountain didn't come to Mohammed, Mohammed went to the mountain and described the program. People responded. Some of them responded, they came in, some of them said we're interested but it isn't possible, and it worked out in roughly that way. This might not be possible in a large congregation, but finally you're going to get into a situation where you're going to say, do you think it's time to start now? Well, the best time to start is when a few people say, let's get moving with it. And let those people move, and then continually keep the rest of the congregation informed on what's going on, and saying, and say, we'll start another koinonia whenever you're ready. I don't know if that answer, or is there a further question?
Well, yeah. I mean, the concern that I have, of course, is partly how do you avoid it becoming just sort of legitimation of cliques, and I'm not sure whether a geographical principle of establishment would avoid that or not. But let me just put the question: if you know, in seeing the natural groups happening, developing, if you were to note that they were getting cliquish, or that they were carrying, you know, cliques into this, what would you do at that point?
One thing that's been tried several times is to have a fruit basket upset. Simply say, rather than say, you're getting cliquish, and risk the problem of really disenchanting that particular group, you'd say, all right, we have been working for 6 months, and I think maybe it would be good if we would realign our groups. That's a possibility. I think a leadership is really important here. I don't want dictatorship. But leadership, at this point, I think it's important that we do this. And that leadership can come, I guess, often has to come from the pastor of the congregation, but I don't think it has to necessarily from any one person. I might mention one other thing, that very frequently these groups will take a vacation in the summer. And that's a great time in which to make your shift. Yeah.
Okay, sort of covered it, but where does the pastor's family fall into this? Which, as far as the group in...
You want to answer that?
Well, we have two groups going at Holy Sacraments, and so far I have been going to both. But when the leaders were chosen in the groups, one has already chosen a leader, the other has not, then we decided that that we would both go only by invitation. And that is how we have been attending now. Though I would simply choose, go into one of the groups by myself if.
But how about the pastor himself? If his wife is in one, he would want to be, and his family's in one, he would want to be in that same group, wouldn't he?
Yeah, well, yes, that is one of the difficulties of being the pastor of the congregation, because you know in the other group I have this leaders group, of which the pastor is the leader, and he and his wife would be in that group along, in that koinonia. However, that gets to be sort of a technical koinonia, because you're dealing really with the question of the leadership of the other koinonias. And so that's a problem, and I guess maybe I might as well admit my ignorance. I'm not sure just where that ought to work out. Yeah, you had it, and then you.
Herb, you may have talked about this previous evenings that I wasn't here. Do you see that, did I hear you say that the koinonia groups each function with the whole life of the congregation as their concern? So that each koinonia group would be responsible for some concern with worship, evangelism, learning, social ministry. Is that correct?
Do you have?
Or does that exist in addition to? Does that structure, that traditional structure, exist in addition to the koinonia groups?
Did you get this?
No.
Okay. Except for one word, the small group. It exists with the purpose of fulfilling the five functions, mm-hmm. which I believe are just about what you have said: worship, yeah. fellowship, witness, service, and nurture, but not specifically the five functions for the whole congregation. That is, that small group may be coming together. They will have their own worship service, which I did mention this earlier. There will be a covenanting in the group. That this does not mean that we don't go to church on Sundays, because we get really good vibes out of this. Occasionally people will say that. But it means we do attend church on Sunday. We do want to be part of the full community. However, we also feel that as a small group, there is some way in which we can make a contribution, or maybe turn on the rest of the congregation. The one of the groups at Holy Sacraments has, under the leadership of its leader, is becoming involved in Bread for the World, something which has been talked about a lot in the large congregation. We ought to. You're all acquainted with Bread for the World, aren't you? Yeah.
Well, I guess my question is, who or how would the education program of the parish, Sunday church school, vacation church school, mm-hmm. whatever, adult education, whatever it does in education, how would that be administered and organized? Would there still be a board for education?
Yes, there would continue. Let me say, if the congregation wants a board for education, yes. However, as the koinonias have developed, we have found cases where a koinonia has said, we happen to have a number of people in this group that really are interested in this whole educational process, and last year it was a disaster. We'd like to take this over. But I'm sure that if you're dealing with a large congregation, you will want these boards. But the boards are not going to have to, the boards, I guess, are not going to have to do all the work. They really can be what boards ought to be.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the theory in the traditional
yeah.
model, too. But often it happens that the
that's
board
right.
people does all do all the work.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, a question back there.
I don't have a question. I'd like to share the experience that I've had being in a church where we did this. It wasn't a very traditional church to begin with, but it was a church that needed intergenerational experiences, because there were many single people, both young and old, and many broken families, that's the term you choose to use, and or single parent families or odd arrangement of families. And we chose to do this once a month in place of worship. And so everybody in the congregation was broken up. And the first time it was done by a couple people making lists and assigning everybody to a group. And that was a little bit difficult because you had to make sure that ex-wives and ex-husbands and current wives and ex-girlfriends and everybody like that didn't get in the same group. So that was what was done by a couple people who knew everybody. But then the second time we did it, it was done by listing everything that everybody might be in a group about, and then you voted until it was gotten to the point. You must realize that this group numbers quite votes about 80 at a meeting. And you voted until finally it got down to about the 6 most popular subjects. And then everybody got to choose to be in one of these 6 groups. And this is done over a series of Sundays. And so then you had your groups, then everybody was divided up into about 6 groups. And that was, and the pastor was part, was in one of those groups. And, so, and then also, it was intended that there be leadership from each group that went and had a meeting with the pastor separately, as your model suggests. Well, that didn't work so very well. The one in the group I was in could not appoint a leader. We could not choose somebody who would be leader. We tried rotating it, and I think what we did was miss all the leaders' meetings in the end. Or most, big little But, and then they broke up again. And then it seemed that some of the groups continued for like 2 years. And some of the groups ended after 1 year. And we had very definite times where the group was reassessed so that you could decide whether you wanted to continue. I think, though, that we accomplished some of the things that you wanted to do with your koinonia. Because and the group set goals at the beginning and decided how much commitment was going to be involved in a variety of things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. Yeah.
Question I have that's been alluded to several times, or at least it's been skirted, is there any danger in this of ending up with a little congregation with the little congregations within the congregation, so that Sunday morning becomes superfluous? That is, people find their Christian nurture, they find their Christian fellowship, they find their counseling, they find what they want in out of church in the little group. And that the mass meeting of sermon and song sort of fades into second, third priority.
Is there a danger? I'd say yes. But
it would actually happen.
I don't think our track record is long enough for it to have happened. I can say that the congregation in which I've been using this is a congregation that has had sort of a cavalier approach to Sunday services anyway. One Sunday there'll be 30 in church, and another Sunday there might be 7 or 8. It's that way. However, when we started the small group, it's the experience that, if anything, the attendance in our regular services increased. There is one aspect of it that these small groups are attempting to keep in touch with each other. And I guess that's one thing I didn't mention as clearly as I might have, that when summer comes, when the time comes that you might think in terms of having a vacation or something, or an outing, one evening the two groups may get together and say, well, we've been meeting together as individual groups, let's have a picnic somewhere together. Or they will share certain responsibilities in the congregation. And two of the most interesting things that happened, these were in St. Louis. One of them was where a group became very much interested in deaf people, so there was a deaf congregation that had a similar group, so they met together. And the way the deaf people were trying to teach the hearing people the basics, basic sign language. And after a while, laughing at each other. You never laugh at a deaf person, but when a deaf person can laugh at you, and that happens. The second was when they had a koinonia group in a white congregation that met with a similar group in a black congregation. And the people who were there said that the first hour was an absolute unmitigated disaster, because everybody sat there very quietly and very politely, and all of a sudden, one of the black people cracked a joke. It just opened up like that. But you see, that way in which people are reaching out to each other, and I think often people say, boy, I'm really beginning to appreciate what the full service can mean. This is great, but it's one part of my Christian worship. That's where you can have your pulpit prince and your great music. Yeah.
That sounds a little bit like what I think the Methodist Church has been built on ever since it was founded in the 18th century. That is the Methodist classes. And if you get enough classes in a community, then you form a congregation. But I have discovered in talking with some of these that they really are members of classes, and they're members in all of their lives, the rest of their lives, once they become a part of it. And here is where they find the real Christian nurturing going on. And then, yes, on Sunday morning, just as you say, they want to go down, they want to hear the Pope of Prince, the great organ, and the mass choir. But that is not window dressing, it's at best inspirational. But the nitty-gritty of the faith is the little group, and so the little group really becomes the church. And they sort of have the festival gatherings once in a while, their cathedral experiences, by getting the various classes together.
I've seen this in Presbyterian churches where they have the schooners and they're at all of the different levels, and also in Baptist churches where they have that Sunday school class that they become loyal to long after they have left the community. They're loyal to that Sunday school class.
Okay. Yeah, Marie.
In regards to that part about did it take the place of church services, or did anyone stop coming to church services because they had this small group? I don't know about other places, but I know what happened in ours. And it certainly did not mean that people quit coming to the church services on Sunday morning. In fact, those were the people we saw in church. Those were the people who were definitely coming. You could count on those. They knew they were going to come. There was one point that you brought up there that we did not do, and I thought there's one case over here where a group fell apart for want of a leader or something to that effect. Was that the way? Mm-hmm. They never did get one chosen. It just wasn't done that way in our community. And see, the leaders were chosen first. That is, they were asked first. There were volunteers, so those were leaders. And then, since we still needed two or three, but then the pastor asked, there was a lot of praying being done about it, and the extra leaders were found. Then the groups were formed. And so then in each of those groups, the leader's name, leader and his wife, those two were the leaders. They their names topped the list, and so the leader was chosen first. Therefore, when you come to a group, you don't need to be afraid that you're going to be chosen as leader.
Were they all men?
Oh, no.
You say leader and his wife.
Yeah, and I did reword that. Maybe I didn't make that clear. The leader and his wife, they did do that together. They worked on it together, they met together, and the wife always did part of the session, and the husband always did part of the session. But it worked out better that way. And there were some cases where there wasn't a couple at all. So the women led some. But I don't know why it makes it so hard for the pastor and his wife to attend. But if they do attend, that's not in our community. If they did attend, then it inhibited the leader to in real freedom. So his koinonia was, the pastor and his wife's koinonia was the one where they had with the leadership, the leaders in there.
Yeah. This, I think, you've got to face, that the pastor of the congregation is, if he attends a group regularly, he's going to inhibit the leadership. Whether he wants to or not, I don't see any way out of it. And there are ways in which that thing can be handled. One of them is that if you are coming into a congregation with that program, I think it might be good for the pastor to and the board of elders or someone to say, there are some people whom we would call facilitators to get this thing moving. But let's realize that when the time comes to choose leadership in the congregation, leadership in the small group, the facilitator or facilitatoress is not any more a candidate for the leadership of that group than any other person of the group. And that leader of the group is not necessarily going to be the best teacher in the group. The leader's responsibility really is to lead people in what it means to be a follower of Jesus Christ. And I'm sure that the person who can teach it best is not necessarily the person who can show it best. And so it may be that someone will say, I'm leader of this group, but you can do the teaching. And I'd like that part, the person delegates it. He doesn't do everything. So it's that kind of an understanding, and this is done in these groups with a tremendous amount of prayer and consideration, and we have found that when the choice of the leader is made, that the group gathers together and implores the blessing of the Holy Spirit upon that person to give the leadership which the group needs. And very frequently, at your first glance at a group, you don't have a clue as to who will finally emerge as a leader. In fact, the person who acts that way probably won't. Now, you had another...
Well, I was concerned about the process of selecting the leaders and the specific duties of the leader. It seems to me that having one person be a leader and another person be the teacher would be difficult, because I thought that the leadership committee in part was reviewing the lesson and the devotional materials and so on.
Yeah. Normally I think you're right that the leader would be the leader is responsible for the material that's going to be covered. It becomes a little difficult if another person is actually going to take on the teaching responsibility for that time. And I guess but I don't see it as absolutely impossible that the leader would at least lean on the teacher in the group and say, listen, you can at least help me with these techniques. I'm getting the material. Can you help me with it? But where the duties of the leader are, I believe, should be centered in the questions of what we Christians take so very seriously. The confession of sins, and by this I'm not talking about having a list and having private confession, but rather that we begin to consider our weaknesses and difficulties and to be able to have some person there who will listen and respond with a message, respond with the message of forgiveness, and possibly with the message of, listen, you don't understand what you're doing. This, you are not coming here. You're coming here for an excuse. Let us say someone comes along and begins to pour out bitterness. Maybe the leader is going to have to say something else. But that's a task which I don't see is particularly reserved to a pastor of a congregation. People have the gift for it. How often haven't our parents had the gift for that when we were off base, to call us to task, but ultimately to bring to apply the gospel to the situation in which each person is living? And as that person struggles for how to do it, that's where the support group of the leader's koinonia comes in and informs it. I'm not absolutely sure that if you have a group where there are divorced people, that you simply want to make sure that the former wife and former husband are not in the same group. Maybe we ought to ask ourselves whether our Christian understanding is such that people who have gone through a divorce and are no longer married to each other can now begin to deal on this level of Christian responsibility, speaking to each other. It's tough, but we don't want just the easy ones.
How do the others become involved in the koinonias?
Yeah, I think that there are frequently people whose whole background has turned them off from the church. They are not members of a church. They might be the sort of people that you can invite in to one of these koinonia groups, and it has happened in some cases that these people have said, this is what I want. And I don't think it's up to us to say, listen, unless you're a member of St. John's Lutheran Church, this, you can't be a member of the Koinonia. On the contrary, basically, I think we want to have members of the church in the Koinonia, but we ought to be open to that. It may be that you have a Methodist neighbor who's a very good member of that church, who says, I really think that's great. I'd like to be in your Koinonia. And the commitment to be in church on Sundays is just as great with that person. The only thing, he doesn't come to St. John's Lutheran, he goes to First Methodist. That type of thing. And of course, visitors are open. I think I want to recognize you because
of
our...
Did you mention signing contracts when first forming these groups?
Signing contract?
Signing some kind of a contract or something as a commitment?
Not signing, I'm at least making some sort of a commitment. I'm not just, this isn't a revolving door process. But saying, when I take membership in this group, I'm not going to make this as a substitute for my church attendance. And your Methodist or Baptist neighbor who wants to be in the group says, this isn't my way in which I'm sneaking out of the Baptist church. Yeah.
But isn't there a danger that will you bring in some of these people who have this relationship with Christ, but who have their own so-called hobby horse to ride, that they will capture a group so that this can become their expression of the Christian faith, and which would be, you know, the kind that has nothing to do with your institutional church, and use it as a vehicle, say, to become a house church, and really become a divisive type of thing, or a charismatic group come in and take over a group.
Yeah, kind of like what St. Paul did.
Yeah, I think, I would agree that there is that danger. And there's a lovely old hymn that says, we walk in danger all the way. I'm all in favor of that. There's a danger, and that's why we have built into this program that the leadership of the group is in continual contact with the pastor of the congregation and with the whole congregation. Where I see the great weakness of, I think you mentioned it, is really the little church within a church, which is the term for pietism, was that these people literally said, we're going to be our own worshiping community and the rest of these people aren't really with it. And this is one thing that we must make very clear. And we make it clear because we start with the doctrine of baptism. The reason I am a Christ's person is because Christ has captured me in my baptism, not because I walked in there and said, hey, Christ, would you like me? And then we move almost immediately into the question of the person and work of Jesus Christ and what it means to be in the body of Christ. And remind ourselves, even though Grandma Schmidt over here doesn't want to have anything to do with a koinonia, she is continually in church, she has her own faith, we respect this completely. That's where I think we're dealing with that danger. But is there a danger? Yes. If you go to the well, you could fall in and break your neck. If you don't go to the well, you'll die of thirst.
And it can be also in a place where there's a controversy over the pastor, that these groups could become
right.
Subversive.
Right. The pastor might be a dope too. Well, I don't think that ever happens. I guess we have just a few minutes before we're having Vespers a little earlier. So if you want to stretch your legs.
Do you think it's a trend in all the churches doing this type of thing? Because other churches are working on these groups too, are having all these assistants to the pastor.
Oh yes, I think there's a trend in a lot of churches to do it. And I have no delusions about the fact that suddenly this idea sprang full blown out of the heads of two of us, that this is the great original idea. No. What I said in the first meeting, I guess that would be a good thing to close with, is to say once again that what we see as the real essential nature of this thing is, first of all, that it deals with the full functioning of Christianity, of the Christian faith, and that it identifies its own leaders and that it is completely supportive of the full Christian community. Those three things are there. If not, And we think that that emphasis is very helpful in seeing to it that it can really help the Christian community, wherever it is. And it can mean a tremendous amount for an ecumenical understanding. To hear one of the members of the community, if you would see some of this material, and if anyone would like to page through it, it's available with me. To hear one of the members hear a Lutheran approach to baptism and say very sweetly and kindly, I think that's all hogwash. And so we started all over again and we talked about it. And I think after a while his opinion may have changed and we began to respect people who look at baptism from a different viewpoint from that in which we've grown up. Okay, well...
is this the last of your series?
That's right.
Can I just speak to the group and thank you very much for presenting this one last 3 nights?
Pleasure is mine.